Hey, everybody, the first Sunday of the NFL season is in the books. How did your fantasy team do? I crushed it. No one is better than me. Did you win cash? No. With FanDuel, you can tonight. FanDuel is running special Week 1 Monday Night Football contest. You can play today and win money tonight. And take that money and take your girlfriend or your wife out to dinner. Nothing fancy, you know, Dollar Value meal at McDonald's, something like that. FanDuel.com, the leader in one-week fantasy football leagues for real money with immediate cash payouts. The money's real. Entry fees start at just $1. No season-long commitments. No upfront fees. Play each week or whenever you want. You're on a slip and slide? Play. You're at the circus? Play. Yes, I go to the circus. Listen, it's all up to you. Set a new lineup for tonight and win if you're good enough. Tonight only, that's tonight only, pick players from just the Monday Night Football games and win real money in your account tonight as soon as the contest ends. You must sign up by 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time tonight for guaranteed entries into tonight's contest. Go to FanDuel.com and click on the microphone in the upper right-hand corner. Use my code Mercurio, M-E-C-U-R-I-O, and sign up now. New user special. FanDuel will match your first deposit dollar for dollar up to $200. That's up to $200 free, people. That's more than $199. It's $200. It's a lot of money. Offer is only good for the first 50 people to use my code Mercurio. Don't forget to use my code Mercurio. FanDuel.com, where every week is a new season. That's FanDuel.com. Sign up today.
Warriors. Come out to play, Warriors, come out to play.
One game could run this city. One game. Nothing would move without us allowing it to happen.
Hey, folks, welcome to the podcast this week. Very excited to have on somebody that... kind of a hero of mine from being a kid. NFL great Ahmad Rashad, four-time Pro Bowler, played for the Minnesota Vikings and St. Louis Cardinals. Buffalo Bills were mainly known as a Viking. Great, great player and host of NBA Inside Stuff and been a broadcaster for years. Really cool guy and just a great conversation about what it's like to play in the NFL. He was a trash talker in his day and just his whole trajectory, and he's doing this really cool new golf channel called Back Nine. So I was kind of blown away. It's the cool thing about doing this podcast, you get to talk to people that you admired from afar for years, and now they're on your show. So I'm really excited to have him on. I think you're going to like it. Check me out doing stand-up coming up in October 15th to the 19th. I'm going to be at the Cleveland Improv. November 6th through the 8th, I'm going to be at Comics Comedy Club in Foxwoods in Connecticut. November 12th to the 15th, I'm going to be at the Omaha, Nebraska Funny Bone. And in December, December 3rd to the 7th, the Columbus Funny Bone. December 11th to the 14th, the Denver Improv. And December 18th to the 21st at the DC Improv. All right, enjoy the podcast.
We got the streets, suckers! Can you dig it?
Hey, everybody. Welcome to this week's podcast. Very excited to have somebody that I've been a fan of for a long time, Mr. Ahmad Rashad, four-time... Pro Bowler, 1978 Pro Bowl MVP, broadcaster of golf, the NBA, baseball, the NFL for NBC, ESPN, and now the executive producer and on-air host of Back Nine Network, a new golf network on DirecTV that's going to be premiering September 29th. Welcome to the show. I can't believe I'm talking to you because I used to watch you on Sundays playing for the Vikings. Thanks for being on the show.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. It's nice to be here. Man, little did I know I'd ever have an introduction that was that long.
You do. You have a lot. There's a lot of reading I had to do on you. You're frankly, I mean this as a compliment. You're a pain in the ass to research. You got a lot going on.
You know what? There's two ways. It's either that's age or I did something good. Maybe it's both.
No. There's so much I want to talk to you about. We'll talk about the Back Nine Network, but I want to talk about some other stuff. So you've been a big golfer going back a long time, and you spent the year on the morning drive. What prompted you to sort of get involved in the Back Nine Network and tell people what that's about? I know it's a golf and lifestyle show.
Yeah, well, you know, golf has been such a wonderful, it came to me late in life. You know, I didn't start playing golf till I was 50 years old. And because I couldn't run anymore, I mean, I couldn't run or I couldn't get out and play basketball or anything like that. But golf was like the sport that you can play for the rest of your life. And I can remember some of the warm things that I would see when I was going out to play. I'd watch like an older man and his daughter. And she was home from school. I'll never forget this, in Connecticut. I was playing by myself behind them, and I watched the two of them spend, you know, 3.5 hours together. It was like a middle-aged guy, and his daughter was like a college-age student, and it was just the two of them. And they were having the greatest time, or at least having time to spend together.
Yeah.
And it was golf that brought them to that.
Yeah.
So if you can get to a point where it allows you to spend quality time with quality people, and for the rest of your life, you know, it's like, you know, as you get older, you can still play. You play when you're 100. Doesn't even make any difference. But it's a chance to get out and, you know, walk and enjoy yourself and have a nice time. So it's more so a backline network. It is more so a network of golf lifestyle. We won't be doing any golf tournaments or, you know, PGA or things like that. But what we will do is try to grow the game of golf by letting people know about the fashion, the fitness, the lifestyles, the results you can. Just, you know, it's a $100 billion thing, this golf thing where people are just, and so the trick is to find out where all that stuff is.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, what you talk about sort of spending quality time. My son and I play now, and you know, he's a teenager, and it's the best time that we have. I don't take the cell phone. We just went out and played the other day, and he's hitting the ball 225 yards. He's showing off now. He's getting to be a pain in my ass, to be honest with you, because we had a dog leg left par 5, and he decides to cut the trees. And I go, Alex, you're not going to try to do that. He goes, yep. And he did it, man. He used his driver and shot a rocket. He got this thing to go up so fast, so quickly, cleared the trees, had this big smile on his face. And there's nothing better than sitting there and trying to, you know, talking about what club to choose and which way the wind is going. Yeah, it's really great.
Every time that you spend with the kid that otherwise you're going to play video games at home.
We got video games at home, and he does them, but he's not obsessed with them. We kind of we monitor it like we monitor, like, television, you know what I mean?
But, no, my point was the time that you spent together playing golf had to be much better than spending time sitting home playing video games.
Exactly.
Because it opens up, you know, you can have a conversation about anything.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's the problem. And so, like, this has been a great... He just loves sports. Baseball is his prime sport, and basketball, and he just loves anything hand-eye coordination. He loves, and I took it up when I was, I don't know, maybe, you know, 18 or 19 with some friends, but I never really did it a lot. And then once my son got into it, like, we do it a lot now. And so you're going to be not only on air, but producing these shows. Are you going to be traveling with this show, or is it going to be pretty much a studio show for you?
No, it won't be a studio show for me. I will do, when I used to do a show called Inside Stuff, I was promoting all of the players. It was a chance to find out what these players were about. And I learned from Dick Ebersol a long time ago, the way you build interest is through storytelling. It's for me to know more about the person that I'm watching, which will give me more reason to watch. I will have a vested interest in watching somebody if I know something about him. I know that he plays golf every week, but he's got a kid, he's got a wife and 3 kids, and he builds the store himself, or his hobbies are whatever they are, whatever his life stories are, those are the sort of things that make you interested in the person. Now, if I become interested in the person, now I want to watch the guy play on the weekend.
Yeah.
I know that there's more golfers than, you know, Tiger Woods and Rory McIlroy. There's hundreds of them that we don't know anything about.
Yeah.
So to try to show a different side, one of my shows is on Keegan Bradley. And you'll see Keegan like you've never seen him before. You've seen Keegan on television, but you've only seen him under the gun of playing in a tournament, real serious. And when you see him off the course and talking about normal, regular things and his upbringing in Woodstock, Vermont, all those kinds of things, those are the kind of things that sort of, you know, all of a sudden, they're not just for golfers.
People.
It's like, you know, I'm just I don't like golf, but geez, I like that Keegan Bradley. And I think those are the kind of stories that you want to sort of tell and spread that will actually grow the game of golf. It'll be people that will see things and go, man, maybe I should go out and try to play golf.
Yeah, it's true. You know, you did that so well with and to me, you were the first and one of the first players to make that transition so successfully. I think. I mean, I know there was Frank Gifford before you and whatnot, mm-hmm. but like, and I think because of that, you guys can have as broadcasters, former athletes, a connection with the athletes, the current athletes that you're interviewing, that a traditional broadcaster who doesn't have a professional sports background can't have. And I noticed that on NBA Inside Stuff. I used to watch it all the time. I'm a Celtics fan. I grew up in Rhode Island, so I'm a Celtics fan. But I used to, because you clearly, what came through in the lens as a viewer was that you clearly had a relationship with these people. They liked you. You would get them out of their kind of public persona, and you seem to have that ability better than anybody that I remember watching. And was that something that just came automatically to you, or was that something you had to work? Were you benefited by the fact that you were a pro athlete yourself? Where did that come from?
I don't think I've always been a curious person, and I think the only thing that the athletic part helped is because whatever lifestyle that they had, I had one like that too. Mm-hmm. I knew what it was like to be a star athlete and to do all the other things. That was kind of the only sort of common denominator. But in terms of, I always took a lot of pride in bringing out a personality. I mean, I don't think guys that they say, hey, I can't interview that guy. And I want to interview that guy. I know the guy's got a personality. Some of it, maybe you just haven't approached him the right way. You haven't put him in a position where he's comfortable. So mm-hmm. those kinds of things would always make me, they'd get me fired up because it's like, you know, you tell me that this guy doesn't have a personality, I guarantee he's got one. So we would go and we'd put him in a situation where he could only look good. And if a guy had, you know, take a guy out and let him ride some go-karts. And the guy's like 6'11", can't even get in the go-kart thing, but he's got a time of his life. You know, so there's always a little method to my madness to sort of get guys to relax and be themselves. And that was the success of that show because nobody was all uptight and everybody's body was sort of relaxed and we had a great time. And I think that, you know, anybody can do that.
So people understand you... You came out of the NFL, you University of Oregon grad, and you All-American, and you were running back and a wide receiver. What was your first love, running back or wide receiver, and how did you end up getting slotted into the wide receiver role?
Well, when I got to the University of Oregon, I was a tailback. That was the first year I was there. I was a running back. Then the second year, I played wide receiver, which I liked a lot. Mm. I enjoyed being a wide receiver, but my next year, we didn't have a running back on the team, and I actually just made the move because the coach asked me if I would play running back so that we can play some of the other guys at wide receiver, and it would make our team stronger. And even though, you know, you're a wide receiver, would you make that change? Mm-hmm. And I said, yes, I would. So I played running back for those 2 years, and I think that the most – one of the most proud things that I accomplished was when I came out of college, I was like the number one wide receiver and the number one running back in the draft.
Wow.
But I had already made a decision that whatever team drafted me, I was playing no more running back.
Why?
I was going to be a wide receiver. I just didn't, I mean, I'm tall and lanky and, you know, I'd have never played 12 years in the NFL with long as my legs are. And I just didn't want to, I wanted to be a wide receiver. I think I have a wide receiver mentality.
Which is what? What is that? What does that mean?
It's more of an artist. An artist. Mm. I mean, I when I look at the game, I see it in lines and perfection, and you know, it's something you can sort of get into your own little thing and run routes. It's about running a route and really being able to run a route. So I enjoyed that. I really enjoyed that. I really enjoyed to be able to run, you know, a 20-yard out, 20 yards every single time, or a 22 and a half yards every single time. So
yeah, there is a precision. It's like a ballet between you and the quarterback. Yeah,
absolutely. And so it was, that was one of my big things when I was playing. I think I was somebody in the, I had one thing. I was like the Baryshnikov of the NFL. And I enjoyed that. I actually enjoyed that nickname. It was like, yeah, okay, that's about right.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't into the violent part of it. I mean, the violent part, that was just kind of a byproduct. Is that, well, you know, but there is a collision down there.
But there is something about wide receiver that to me seems a little bit more hairy than running back. Okay, you get the ball, you hand the ball as a running back, you're running into the line, you know you've got guys blocking for you, and you know people are coming after you. But to some extent, I feel like you're less exposed than if you're out over the middle and you're running a slant or whatever, and you're going up for the ball, the ball's a little high, and you know you can get upended. Didn't you feel a little exposed as a wide receiver that you're not, in a way that you're not as a running back?
Well, yeah, there is a difference, but on the other hand, having played running back, the best thing about being a running back is the game got easier when you got tackled by defensive backs because they were little guys. So now all of a sudden I'm playing a position where everybody tackling me is a little guy. As opposed to playing running back, everybody tackling me is twice as big as I am.
And there's also
this thing about football, and this goes to all football players that play at that level. There is a feeling of you are invincible. You know,
really?
You train, you work out so hard that mentally – when you play, nothing can hurt you. So it's not about, you know, I'm not concerned about jumping over the middle and knowing that I might get killed when I come down. I probably won't, but you don't worry about it. It's a strange thing. It takes a little while to get over it when you quit. I can remember like a year after I quit and I'd watch it. It's like, how the hell did I do that?
well, there's this conversation happening. Exactly. That's the conversation that's happening right now with Wes Welker in New England. He just had his like 10th concussion and he had something.
But he's supposed to quit. He, you can't do that. You know, this guy's going to, especially with all these head injuries they got going now, you can't have 10. You can't have 10. You're going to have 2 and then you quit and go do something
else. Why isn't he quitting? Doesn't that speak to your point that you feel you put on that? I can imagine a big part of it is you put that uniform on, right?
Yes.
You got the pads, you got the helmet. It's like, I can walk in front of a truck right now. Nothing's going to hurt me, right?
You certainly feel that way. But the most important thing is, more important than that, and this has to happen earlier, I was always a full believer in having a full life. You know, I didn't live and die for football. You know, football, when I was in high school, football happened between 3 and 5. There was a lot of other shit that happened between 8 and 5. You know, in the morning till 5 o'clock, there were so many other different things in life. And then after 5 o'clock, there was just, the world was full of a lot of different opportunities to do stuff. And football or sports just took up one slot. It didn't take up more slots. So from 3 to 5, I was really into the football thing. About 5:30, I was looking for something else to do.
I
went to sleep and I worried. So maybe guys like that have all those concussions don't have an alternative.
Oh yeah, that's
like,
a good point.
What else are they gonna do? What else? So, and that's not good. That's why I've always felt like the key thing to tell young athletes is, man, you got to have a lot of stuff to do. Whatever, even if you play 10 years, that's like 1/10 of your life.
Yeah, exactly.
So how important can it be? It can't be that important.
Right, exactly.
Attention to something that lasts for you the rest of your life.
Exactly. I mean, you're 35 and you've got another 40, 50 years to live and you've got to figure out the next part of your life. What's act
two,
right?
Yeah. Absolutely. When you can really work on act two while you're on act one.
Yes.
At least have a plan.
Did you have a plan for broadcasting? Because you seemed so natural at it. Did you?
Absolutely.
I've always had
plans. I'm still making plans. But it was one of those things like, the worst thing is like I had to go to sleep at night because it meant the day was over. Like I can't wait for the next day so we can do something else.
Yeah.
So, and it was not hard for me to quit. When I said I was done playing football, I think I left at the top of my career.
Mm-hmm.
At my top of my career, I just walked away. And
I do remember those conversations in the articles. It's like you were coming off your fourth year as a pro bowl. You were at the top of your game, and people were like, "Wow!" But then when you saw you doing the broadcasting thing, you kind of go, "Oh, okay, I get it." Like this guy clearly. You didn't wake up that, first training camp or first season when you weren't playing?
No.
Boy, I kind of miss it.
The first training camp, I was in Paris. I had been in Paris for about 4 months. I had forgot that they even had training camp.
I forgot. I mean, I really didn't miss it at all. I was gone. I was just on to the next thing.
Yeah.
And it was, and I missed weird things. You know, I missed the camaraderie of the guys in the locker room. I missed the joking. The joking around that, you know, nothing was, you know, no holes barred joking around. I missed that. To be able to say anything you wanted to somebody, which you can't really say in real life, but
yeah,
in the locker room, you know, I just missed that. That's the only thing I sort of missed. And it took me a bit of time to sort of adjust to that, that, you know, in normal life, you can't be as blunt as you can in the locker room.
Right, right. You know, yeah.
There are certain ways that you have to sort of handle that. So, but that was the only part. But I never did. I never looked back at all. I just was, you know, I was just ready to go on to the next thing. Just on to the next thing.
What was it like to catch that Hail Mary pass in 1980 against the Browns that ultimately won you the game and the title?
I think what people have to sort of realize is that I wasn't surprised. I knew I was going to catch it. You know, so it wasn't like it didn't surprise me. It was like, hey, look at here, ball. It's like I knew I. It's like, yeah, I'm supposed to do that. I mean, that's what I, you know, I think a lot of people don't ever take it from that sort of standpoint, because to the crowd, it's like, oh man, this is the greatest play and what a surprise. Well, the person that did it, I don't think it was a surprise. I mean, that was your intent, was to make a touchdown. So you made a touchdown. So that was kind of, I think it was cool, you know, the timing with the clock running out and the you know, the people in the stands. It was a great moment, a great moment. And I sort of, you know, can never get back to it. It was so long ago. But it was just part of the fun that I had. But it wasn't surprising. I mean, I had caught balls to win games a lot of times, and this was just another one. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't. I guess the good thing is we won the championship, too. You know, we won the game, won the championship, so it was kind of a big deal. Somehow, I don't know, I was always able to keep it in check. I don't know. I don't know why. It just
But don't you think that attitude of, like, I was going to check it or I knew I was going to catch it, is the reason that you excelled at such a high level? Like, you're 0.1% to be able to play in the NFL, then to be at the, you know, the top of that heap as a Pro Bowler. And, like, how much of this game, not just the game, but in life, is mental, attitude, confidence? Michael Jordan, who I know you're a close friend with, and Tiger Woods, I know you're a close friend with him, they have it, obviously, this sort of competitive edge, but in immense amount of confidence versus physical ability. You know, what is the right mix there, and how important is that?
It is, you know, I guarantee you, when you see people do great things at a professional level, mm-hmm. that same person has been doing that since Little League.
Yeah.
That's the same guy that won the Little League game when you were 12. That's the same guy that hit the shot when you were 15 in junior high school.
I want to talk to you about TrueCar.com. TrueCar.com is changing car buying forever. Yes, every day, TrueCar users receive negotiation-free, guaranteed savings. Some features not available in all states. In the first 3 months of this year, over 126,000 cars were sold by the TrueCar Certified Dealer Network. TrueCar users save an average of $3,078 off manufactured suggested retail price. When you're ready to buy a car, just follow these three easy steps. First, go to TrueCar.com and find out what other people paid for the car you're looking for. Then, register at TrueCar.com to see upfront pricing information and lock in your savings. Third step is simple. Just print out your TrueCar savings certificate and take it to the TrueCar certified dealer for a better, hassle-free buying experience. Remember, every day, TrueCar users receive negotiation-free, guaranteed savings. Save time, save money, and never overpay. Visit TrueCar.com today. That's TrueCar.com.
No, I think it's your approach. It's mental. It's your approach. And it's like practice makes perfect. It just didn't happen, but you've done it so many times, not only in your mind. You know, people try to say that stuff, but you have to do it in actuality. You know, you've done it so many times in a game. You've done it so many times in whatever, in practice. You've done it so many times so that it becomes part of who you are. Mm-hmm. And that same guy does that stuff all the way through his whole career. It's never a guy that all of a sudden gets to the pros and all of a sudden he becomes that guy. That doesn't happen.
And you were like that from a young age. You just had that confidence. Right. You'd kind of walk out there. And was football your sport as a kid, or were you into other sports?
I was a really good athlete. I played basketball and I ran track and I jumped 6'9" when I was in 17 years old.
6'9"? Jesus.
Yeah, I think the world's record was 7 feet at that point. And so I jumped 6'9". So those were, you know, it was, I don't know if it was, you know, it's just, I think it was just your approach to it. Mm-hmm. It was your approach to it. And at every level, I was fortunate that no level was harder than, you know, when I was in junior high school. And then I got to high school, it was still, you know, still the same. I got to college, got to pro, never got to the point where it was so hard that I couldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I quit before it got, you know, the only thing that was going to slow you down, you play too long and, you know, now you're old playing against young people. I never was going to be that guy.
Right.
But I just think that the most important thing for being able to play in the NFL was it gave me a tremendous amount of time to do other stuff. You know, that was back in the day. They didn't have a lot of off-season training camps. You know, you just played from July.
So what were you doing with your downtime?
Oh, God, I traveled, I read, I did everything I wanted to do. I went to school. I did whatever. I lived in different places during the off season.
Mm-hmm.
I would, when I was in Minnesota, I'd live half the off season in Hawaii, the other half in Los Angeles, and then you know, I just sort of moved around and met a lot of people that did a lot of different things.
Mm-hmm.
And had that freedom to do that.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, you kept me as a Viking fan because I started being a Viking fan because of Fran Tarkenton, and then I liked you and I stuck with it. And I grew up in New England, and I'm also a Patriots fan, but I kept, and those were the days when we had Steve Grogan, and we weren't very good.
Yeah.
We weren't, you know, and it's funny because my son, you know, we were supposed to beat we had that perfect season going a few years ago, and we were supposed to, you know, we were 18-0 going into the Super Bowl and all that.
Right.
And we, you know, we lost to the Giants. I can't even hear the name David Tyree. I get my skin crawls. But anyway, my son starts crying. He's like 7 at the time. I go, Alex, you don't understand. Now they had already won 3 Super Bowls, right? This would have been the 4th. I'm like, you have no idea how many years we went as a New England fan without even making the playoffs, let alone winning a world championship. And he's had 3 in, you know, 7 years, but you were very dynamic. Like there was just something about you. You were electric on that field. You gave off a vibe, and not just in the way you moved, but just in your eyes. You were like a guy that just, there was something, the camera liked you too. Like you could just get that vibe. It was a vibe that you gave off as a viewer that like watching you like this, there was just something a little special and different about you than the other guys on the field.
I felt that I approached my job as the ultimate professional.
Mm-hmm.
I was professional 100% about that game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was not going to ever make a mistake. I was not going to know where I was supposed to. I mean, I took my playing very seriously. You know, I really, and I enjoyed that. It was just, it was a wonderful way to, I guess it was like a painter when you get like inspired and you know, something takes you, or a musician and you get inspired and you get able to take it to another level. Well, I got to do that every Sunday. And my point was to take it to another level.
Yeah.
Take it to that level every single week. Not like, well, you know, last week was that. Well, you know what? This week's going to be something else. And it was enjoyable. It was very much enjoyable.
Speaking of that, do you have any sort of, you know, without, I don't want you to say anything compromising about you or anybody, but like anything that has happened on the field in college days or NFL that just made you laugh in the moment, like you couldn't believe it. Do you, you know, like just a crazy moment that
there were
maybe,
so
maybe,
many times.
That maybe like
there
the,
so
the
many,
average fan wouldn't know, like anything,
you know,
that comes to mind.
There were so many times I talked a lot and you couldn't tell that. You couldn't tell if I was talking a lot.
Oh, you're a trash talker?
You're in the stands. You could not tell that I was talking. I talked to everybody.
What would you say?
It would be the point where they would not, you know, it would be their coach. If they ever got caught talking back to me, then it would be problems. You know, the whole time they'd be like, don't talk to him. Don't talk to him. Because I'd be talking about something, I don't know what the hell. I mean, just something that wasn't even, had nothing to do with that game. You know, so it's like, don't talk to him. You're just going to take your focus away. Do not talk to him. So I'd always talk to my friends that played the other team and say, well, you know, I'm going to just tell you now how you're doing because, you know, the coach won't let me talk to you. They won't let any of us talk to you. So I spent the whole day there, man. Shit, what are you, like 12? Coach wanted to talk to you? It was just a lot of, and it was like that, though, every game with everybody. So it's always funny to me when some young guy would try to trash talk to me. It's like, you better go find out who you're talking to.
And then
you just messed up.
Did you ever get under somebody's skin to the point where they like took a swing at you? Got in a fight during a game?
In sports there is a respect level that, you know, they might have wanted to, but you know, I wasn't a bad guy. I mean, I was a good guy. I was the one that you didn't want to hit me because your mom liked me. You know? It's like, you can't hit me. You might hit somebody else, but not me. You know, your family like me. I was a good example for all of us. You know, it's like, yeah, okay, well, I do my interviews. I'm going to speak well. I'm going to do those. So you can't.
Yeah.
You got to go hit somebody else. Go hit that other guy over there that can't talk or whatever he is. But that's really bad.
So what was the biggest learning curve for you becoming a broadcaster? And what did you take from being a professional athlete that helped you in that endeavor?
Ed Bradley was a very good friend of mine.
Oh yeah.
And sort of took me under his wing when I first started working. But when I started working at the network level.
Yeah. For people who don't know, let me just say, Ed Bradley was a 60 Minutes CBS News 60 Minutes correspondent and a great journalist.
So. What people didn't understand is that when I got to the network, which was right when I finished playing football, for the previous 5 years, I had worked at a CBS affiliate in Minneapolis full-time. Hmm. So I had sort of gotten all the kinks out. I was writing all my copy. I was producing all my features. I was doing live television 3 times a week on the local market. So by the time that I got ready to quit and moved to New York, I was pretty much polished. So when I first came on, when the national audience saw me, they went, whoa, that guy's a natural. Well, I wasn't a natural. I just got rid of all my bad stuff in those 5 years that every day I went to practice, I left practice going to work. Mm. You know, at the end of the practice, guys would go to the bar and drink and hang out. I would go right to the studio and work for 5 years. I had a radio show and I had 3 television shows that I did during the course of the week because I sort of knew where I was going. Mm. And so when I got to New York, you know, Ed Bradley was such a major star and, you know, he did interviews on all kinds of really heavy, you know, Vietnam War stuff and, you know, heavy stuff, not sports, but he was a huge sports fan and we sort of became very good friends. And I learned a lot, you know, just in terms of how to put pieces together, you know, how to produce pieces, how to find stories, you know, how to do things that, so I always had, you know, nobody does anything by themselves. Everybody needs some help somewhere.
Yeah.
And he was really a wonderful friend that I could call at any time. And he would always call and critique my work.
What was some of the good critique that he gave you, particularly about interviewing and interview style? Like, what did you learn from him?
My most important thing, like, I'm always me. I don't have two sides. I don't have a television persona. Mm-hmm. What he sees pretty much me. So, you know, I don't have to, like, suck myself up to do whatever I do. And I try to do all my interviews, you know, in a very easy, relaxed way that it's always me, very friendly. Even if it's a hard question or whatever it is, you sort of ask it as if you're asking a friend. Mm. You know, it's not like they're trying to, you know, break news or anything like that. And I wasn't doing hard news. And so I realized that. Some people get mixed up with sports stories and hard news stories. They don't mix. They're either one or the other. So at some point, you got to realize you're not doing 60 Minutes. You're doing SportsCenter.
Right.
You know, so
How did you come to have an MBA focus for your broadcasting career? Because, you know, obviously you think, okay, I know you did NFL, I know you did baseball as well. You've done a lot of the sports, but as a broadcaster, I think it's fair to say that the MBA was really sort of your main focus. And where did you get the expertise on the NBA? Why did they think that you could do it? Why were you able to do it so well? How did that happen?
I played basketball in college, and I was a huge basketball fan, basketball fan. And I knew most of the guys in the NBA. I mean, you know, my off seasons that we hang out together or we played basketball at the gyms together or whatever it was. Well, NBC got the NBA. And so in order to sort of launch the NBA, David Stern called me and asked me if I would do a show called Inside Stuff, because he sort of liked the way I, you know, sort of did things. And it would also give me credibility, because we were this big undertaking where the NBA, NBC, was now going to do the NBA. And I was going to be the sideline reporter for our A-team on the NBA. So the thing that would give me credibility, if I did this half-hour show all about basketball, it would give me a credibility with the guys, so it wouldn't be all, it's that football guy. Well, not only did it give me credibility, but if the show was so big that everybody forgot I even played football. and the timing of it was such that, you know, Michael Jordan was just coming into, you know, it was his time to take over the league. Well, Michael and I were very dear friends. And so we worked, and we, you know, we had a Bears, a Bulls game every week. It seemed to me for about 5 years, six straight years, we had a Chicago Bulls game every Sunday, which meant that I was always at the game every single Sunday. So it all sort of came together like that. You know, it just sort of came together like that. Once we got this show started, and I'd have two or three stars on there, I couldn't go to a game without all the players auditioning. The guys would do something great on the court, and they'd run by me sitting there and go, hey, put that on the show. Well, how come I'm not on the show? Hey, well, put that in Rewind. I see that Rewind. Put that in Rewind.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It was one of those things like that. I mean, the show was just off the top. I don't think there will ever be anything quite like that. It was before social media, and we did everything that social media is doing now. You know, you found out a lot of stuff about people.
It was ahead of its time because it really, I loved watching it because I'm a big NBA fan, and it definitely gave you a window into those guys and that world that you didn't get from a traditional broadcast. And I think having you do it because you were, like I said earlier, you had a rapport with those athletes that no one else I think could have had, even the greatest journalists.
That's true.
You know, I really do. I think, and I think they let their guard down with you. And as a result of letting their guard down with you, as a viewer at home, it was really fascinating to watch.
Yeah, and it didn't matter if you were a basketball fan or not. You would watch anyway. I've ran into so many people that, you know, over the years ago, oh, God, I remember every Saturday morning I watched that show. And I had a lady tell me on a plane the other day, and I said, did you watch the show? I said, did you watch, who was your favorite team? She goes, I didn't have a favorite team. I just liked the way you showed those guys. Well, that's wonderful.
Right.
That's what I was trying to do.
Exactly.
That's what I was trying to do.
Because there's a sign of him. I had Peter Vesey on the on my podcast, and you know, he talks about his days in the NBA, and he talks about, like, he's got some great stories, like he was in Chicago, and Larry Bird was in his car, and somebody else, it might have been Charles Barkley, and he had just gotten, like, a new BMW or something, Vesey did, and it was, like, all leather seats, so Larry Bird brings in, like, a six-pack of beer with him, and then shakes the six-pack and threatens to open all the cans, and, you know, that's stuff that, you know, you guys on the inside see, but it humanizes these people, especially to us now, because it's become such, it was a big business then, but even a bigger business now, and it's so corporate. And everybody's, you know, so on message and has press people covering them and blah, 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 blah. It was a great show, and it's great to, like, stories like Peter's, it was great to hear because it just, you know, it's, we have regular guys who happen to shoot basketballs for a living or catch footballs for a living, but you're...
Absolutely. You know, not any different than the people that live right down the street from you. They're not any different from that guy that you know, your cousin down there who ended up being 6'8" when he was in the 10th grade that ended up going on and playing somewhere. It's not any different. They're not different. They're the same. And, and it's nice to... Now, what I'm doing with the Back Nine Network is the same thing. Mm-hmm. Like I told you about Keegan Bradley, you'll see Keegan, because he's from, you know, he tried to say he's from Woodstock, but he didn't keep going and say, man, not that Woodstock. You're from Woodstock, Vermont. Make a difference.
Right.
You know, he's trying to be cool, saying you're from Woodstock. Yeah, okay, Woodstock. But, man, we have fun. It's a lot of fun. It's you see guys like you've never seen them. I think that we have done Bill Murray. I mean, you didn't know Bill Murray grew up being a caddy at a golf course in Chicago.
Oh,
you know,
that's
just
great.
Golf so important to him and really a major part of his life, and how that his brother got a golf scholarship for being the best caddy at this club, and how he really knows about groundskeeping on golf courses because he worked for a groundskeeper for 3 years. So he really knows the cut of the grass and the when you should punch the greens. I mean, and to see a guy sit there talking like that, it's like, I thought this guy was just a movie star. But all of a sudden, it's something that's common ground. You know, we have Michael talking about, you know, how he was the honorary captain of the President's Cup. Mm-hmm. You know, how that was and how he's, you know, he explains it by saying, you know what, it was like a two-edged sword because I didn't want my influence to be too big at their event. You know, it's the President's Cup. It's these players' event. I don't want to overshadow that by even being there.
Right.
You know, and I don't want to, you know, the only thing I do if they want to ask me something, I can tell them, but I can't tell them anything about golf. I can tell them about the approach to the game, but I don't want to take away their moment. Now, to hear him say that, you know, when you hear somebody like that say that, you get a different, you start to feel like, you know, this is who these people are.
Yes.
You know, this is more, and this is what I do. This is, I do that.
Well,
I think
it's
my
funny.
Views are pretty much the same.
Yeah, I think it's great because I've actually, you know, my background is I've worked on The Daily Show for a number of years, and I always felt like that there's like some humorous stuff about sports that you could do. So I've done some stuff with sports and comedy. I did an HBO sports comedy series for HBO for the web and for the HBO sports. And, you know, Bob Costas did a segment where he interviewed me as the asterisk, and I play the asterisk, which is, I think, the most powerful symbol in sports. And, you know, I personify the asterisk and we make jokes about it. And I think I talk about this a lot, that it has a bigger influence on my son than any other part of our culture right now. We go to church, my son goes to school, all that other stuff, but like he gets up, ESPN SportsCenter's on, he'll read the sports page, like, and he's getting life lessons, whether you like it or not, from sports. And I think sports can use more of the kind of thing you're talking about, the human interest and the light comedy around it too, because I think that when you start to show these people as real people, flaws and all, in a fun way, interesting way, I think that it makes bigger fans out of their already existing fans.
I agree. Know? And you know what else? No matter what you think, there's always another game.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't want to. I had the greatest coach in Bud Grant. His philosophy was that you prepare as hard as you can, you play as hard as you can, and then you go home and have dinner.
Yeah. That's a good point.
This guy was marvelous, man. He was wonderful. He was like the coolest dude that I ever he had more influence over me as a coach than anybody ever had. Nothing was gonna give him, he ain't gonna ever get an ulcer, none of that stuff. This older thing is like, you know what, I'm preparing as hard as I can, I'm gonna play as hard as I can, then I'm gonna go have dinner. You know, I don't sleep in my office. I don't, you know, the coaches that would sleep in their office and watch film, 8,000 hours of film. That's crazy stuff. I'd rather have my surgeon doing that, not the damn football coach. To me, it sounds like you're a little slow. If you got to watch it that many times, you're not that smart.
That's a good point. I never thought of that. That's hilarious.
You got to watch that shit that many times, you are not that smart.
I bet you would have been a good pro golfer. Did you ever think about that? You should have started that earlier in life. I bet you would have been a really good.
No, because I realize what it takes. You know, there's a sacrifice. Like, I could never get myself. I mean, you know, Michael and I were talking about this yesterday. Playing golf yesterday, and we were talking about it. And I said, you know what? Even though we play and we really compete against each other really hard, neither one of us approached this like we did our sport.
Yeah.
You know, when I approached my sport, there was no stone unturned. I mean, there was a real commitment to it. I don't want to have that kind of commitment to golf. I want golf to be recreation.
Yeah,
and every now and then I want to hit a ball like a pro. I want to be a kid. So every now and then I want to hit one like Tiger. If I can just hit one, it's like, you know what, that feeling is enough for me to come out here and play again. But I'm not so stupid that I think that I'm good enough to be a pro. I know that's not the case.
Yeah, that's true. It's funny, you know, somebody said to him, you know, you should play golf for your school. He goes, nope. I'm not doing it. Like they said, because then it'll stop being fun. You know, right. I like it just the way it is. It's something I do for fun.
That's
I enjoy it. You know, like that's his outlet.
Good.
you know, he's got baseball and he's got basketball as his main thing. So, listen, I want people to watch this Back Nine channel, make it a big hit September 29th on DirecTV. It comes out and we're going to be seeing a lot of you on that. And,
and you golf lifestyle.
Yeah. And you going to be, are we going to be seeing you, doing any more, other sports, covering any other sports? You're going to be focusing on golf right now.
I still do the NBA. I do four, specials a year for the NBA.
Mm-hmm.
I still do that. That show's called One on One with a Mazda Shot.
Yeah.
And we do that four times a year, beginning of the year, Christmas, All-Star weekend, and the finals.
Okay.
So I will never, ever stop doing basketball. Basketball still is my love. I love that more as a spectator sport. It's great. Mm-hmm. Absolutely wonderful.
Hey, speaking of nice guys like yourself finishing first, and nice things happen to nice guys. It was nice to see Doc Rivers get that re-up
Doc
on.
Rivers, Doc Rivers is a wonderful, wonderful dude.
$50 million.
He played golf with Doc today.
Is that right?
He was supposed to play golf with, but he's home. He left to go back to Orlando for Monday's holiday.
Oh man, I want your life. You're playing golf with Doc Rivers and Michael Jordan, and I want your life for like 24 hours.
Man. They're just good dudes. They're good, good, solid cats. You know, that's important. As you get older, it's important. That's what lasts.
Yeah,
Exactly.
Well, listen, I can't thank you enough for doing this. I really mean it. It was really an honor to talk to you because I remember sitting in my parents' living room watching you run around that television like a bat out of hell catching footballs, and then watching you on NBC. It's a great thing about doing this is I get to people talk to heroes and people that I really admire. So September 29th, DirecTV, Back Nine
right.
Channel, Ahmad Rashad and the NBA one-on-one with Ahmad Rashad. And, stay in touch, and I'd love to talk to you again down the road sometime. But thanks for doing it,
man.
I really appreciate
it. No problem. Anytime you need me, just reach out. It'd be no problem. And keep playing golf with your son, man. That's quality time, man.
It's
That's
great.
Better than playing with Michael or Doc.
I don't know. I got to be honest with you. I would give up one day of my life to play with Michael or Doc or you. I would tell my son. Or maybe we'd do a foursome sometime. Me, my son, you, Michael, and Doc. My son will sit there the whole time with his jaw on the ground, just going like, "What?
Oh my
what is,
God!"
But it's too funny. But all right. Well, thank
all
you.
Right,
and that's Ahmad Rashad, everybody.
All right, and that was Ahmad Rashad. How great was this guy, huh? And look at his life this guy's got. Yeah, I was hanging out with Michael Jordan. Yeah, I was playing golf with Tiger Woods. Just 2 hours. That's all I want, 2 hours of his life. That's all. Anyway, check me out doing stand-up. I got some great gigs coming up in the upcoming months in October. October 15th to the 19th, I'm going to be at the Cleveland Improv. November 6th through the 8th, Comics Comedy Club in Foxwoods, Connecticut at the Foxwoods Casino. And November 12th to the 15th, Omaha, Nebraska, the Omaha Funny Bone. December 3rd to the 7th, the Columbus Funny Bone. December 11th to the 14th, the Denver Improv. December 18th to the 21st, the DC Improv. Thanks, people.
You take over one borough at a time. Secure our territory. Secure our